basically.
Check.
Society itself.
Check.
That's maybe something that we could do effectively that other podcasts aren't going to do. What else? Where else are you going on?
Varn wants to do something.
Varn will be good for the
theater. Varn will be awesome. But you never know where he's going to take it. Like, yeah. I mean...
At the Drive-In, live.
It does sound like At the Drive-In.
It does sound like At the Drive-In. Did I ever tell you my At the Drive-In story?
No.
I'm not sure it's very pertinent to this episode. Folks, hello. Welcome. We're recording an episode. No, I saw At the Drive-In open up for Sunny Day Real Estate in front of like 100 people in like 1998 or something like that.
Wow, ahead of the curve.
Ahead of the curve. And they had all their chops and everything, and no one had heard of them. They're like, who the fuck are these guys from Texas? They're awesome. And it was At the Drive-In. That was pretty cool.
Well, it does, of course, work with what we're talking about, because those are rock bands.
Yes.
And, of course, we are still listening to rock and roll today because of the Beatles.
Ah, yes.
Who were the product of the Frankfurt School, were the product of the CIA and Herbert Marcuse.
That's it. Just as we today are also products of Marcuse and the CIA here at this podcast. Welcome to the Antifada. I think this is episode 301. We're back here with a veritable returning champion. I think this is your 17th appearance on the podcast. It's probably easier to name off the episodes you haven't been on than the ones you have been at this point. But we have, of course, Ross Wolf. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
I'd love to have Ross not on anymore, but he keeps putting out these bangers.
Bangers, all
we
fucking.
We can't deny him. He's banging down the door.
I know.
And we're talking about your new epic Marxist takedown. It's for the kids out there. This is, you know, this is something we did before YouTube, before you could make a 3-hour YouTube video, you know, mashing up all the clips of a rival streamer,
right,
and going through how they're fucked up one by one, and, you know, put on funny costumes while you do it. Before you could do that, that's the correct way to ideologically battle a rival. Before you could do that, you had to write a 50-page takedown going through the history of various forms of Marxism and Marxist thinkers and publishers.
Now, everyone out there thinks that, you know, they're so innovative and so provocative and disruptive, and people do great interventions. But I'll have you know that the Spartacus League's Workers' Vanguard paper was doing bad empanada like 40 fucking years ago, accusing other people of being pedos and supporting pedophilia and like supporting various like interventions in real life. So this is a blast from the past.
Bad empanada is a normal empanada compared to the Spartacus.
Yeah, baddest empanadas you could ever get. We're here to talk about the banger. Andy, introduce the banger.
So this is about someone who I've never read, although I've seen the name come up a lot from various shady Stalinist gadflies. Among them, of course, the MAGA communists. We're talking about Dominic Lacerto. And what lit this fire within you to torch Lacertism, Ross?
So, I mean, the story about this actually goes back, I think, like 13 or so years.
Man.
Yeah, I know, this has been a long time in the making. But he had this book come out that received a lot of fanfare, Liberalism, A Counter-History.
I have that on my bookshelf, only because, remember, Verso used to throw their parties in the loft? I found the biggest, most expensive book to steal, and I took it home. I never fucking read that thing, but it made a splash. It made a big splash, right?
Yeah. It received a lot of press at the time. A lot of people were talking about it, a lot of rave reviews. And, you know, I was interested in it because I was interested in the history of liberalism and the way that that related to socialism as, you know, the sort of imminent critique of liberalism and its limits. And I actually wound up interviewing the guy. He came to, I believe it was a Left Forum in 2012, and I ended up interviewing him about that that book. It was a somewhat antagonistic interview, and I feel like I was able to corner him on some issues that were near and dear to my heart, namely the his objection to the Marxist doctrine of the withering away of the state. Since that time, there have been any number of other publications that have come out, translations of his work, and I've seen him steadily gain more and more adherence among certain quarters of the left. So he, whereas he may have held a broader appeal earlier, having been published by the New Left Reviews publishing house, which is Verso, of course, he's since come to be more associated with Iskra Books and now with the Monthly Review Press.
And he's ceased to come to be recognized as a dead guy, right? Because he passed away 9 years ago, something like that?
2018.
2018, so 7 years ago, something like that. Well, I will say I first heard of him. I shouldn't say I first heard of him. I first heard of him when I stole that book. But I first encountered a real, like, Lacerdo head when I was called to Chicago for a conference, and some trollish group put me alongside a guy named Carlos Garrido with Midwestern Marx. And it was a conversation about politics, like the definition of politics and where socialist politics might go in the country. But like halfway through it, he started spouting off on, I think, what he was really there for, which was to talk about the Frankfurt School and the theory industry and Western Marxism and the CIA influence on Marcuse, and how critical theory and Trotskyism is basically like an op, like a psyop. Western Marxism is a psyop. So like at the time, I guess I could have anticipated him coming out with this sort of bullshit, and I could have maybe like come up with a rejoinder like beforehand to be like epically own him, but I'm not sure I really care to like be that guy. That's why we have you around, basically. Mm-hmm. That's why we have Ross Wolf, is because you get in there in your article, into the archive, into the theory, into the various books, even into the footnotes of Lacerdo, and you sit down and show that when he's not being wrong, he's being disingenuous, it seems, with a lot of his citations. And also, this entire construct that he creates of Western Marxism, I think you do a really good job in your piece of pointing out that it's kind of confected. It's like thrown together for polemical reasons, maybe not for theoretical reasons. And the whole thing kind of gives off the vibe of like ex post facto trying to defend his sort of neo-Stalinist politics, using and abusing theory. So Carlos Garrido, Midwestern Marx, these people are steeped in Lacerdoism, which I think is why it's really good that you wrote it, because it deserves this if it's going to be a theory to be taken seriously. I'm not sure it is, but it is popular. One of the criticisms you got online from, I think it's somebody from Red Sails, was that Ross Wolf can't explain why it's so popular these days, why Lacerdo is so popular. Maybe we can talk about that.
Yes, because everybody reads Red Sails, and it's a household name. Thanks. Red Sails is one of the gadflies I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Hates Nietzsche, hates postmodernism, extremely Stalinist, extremely defending China. So yeah, Ross, who was Lacerdo?
So Lacerdo, he was an Italian Marxist. He belonged to the PCI, which is the Italian Communist Party, which goes back to the 20s. But after Bordiga left and after Gramsci was imprisoned, it fell under the sway of this guy, Palmiro Togliatti. And he kind of had this sort of popular front strategy. And then after the war, you know, the PCI had a lot of prestige. And that's where Lacerdo came up. He was born in the 40s. And when there was the Sino-Soviet split, he sided more with China. I don't think he really became like a Maoist in the sense of like a Red Guard style guy, but he did side more with the People's Republic over the USSR. And then there was a series of splits within the Italian Communist Party. There was the Euro-Communist attempt, and he, I'm not exactly sure how he fell, but he came to eventually, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, when there was a lot of sort of liberal triumphalism and sort of end of history talk, he began really, whereas before he'd written a bunch of just sort of journalistic articles, he started just pumping out books left and right, recycling a lot of the same material and the same arguments again and again, really in service of like trying to defend actually existing socialism, mm-hmm. such as remained, mm-hmm. as above all the People's Republic of China, and the Dengist market reforms, which he has any number of different rationales that seek to, you know, really justify the course that the PRC has taken.
Interesting. So Italy is this sort of hotbed, right? We're all familiar with, I think, the theory that we're closer to, which would be like autonomism and open operismo, things of that sort coming out of Italy. I guess at the times when Lacerdo's a young man, but he goes another direction. He goes anti-revisionism. Go ahead, Andy. You have a question?
Yeah, would you say that sort of his project comes out of maybe this moment in the early 60s, right, in Italy when the Italian Communist Party was sort of facing which direction it wanted to go, if it wanted to stay more Stalinist under Togliatti or become more like break away into like a more European form of communism?
I think so. He was initially actually very influenced by Althusser, who he later distanced himself from, especially because he became more of an Hegelian, a certain form of Hegelian that I'm not quite as sympathetic to, but he thinks of himself kind of as a humanist, but above all, a realist. So he thinks that Marxism and various aspects of the Marxist doctrine are messianic and utopian, and that it's his project to cleanse Marxism of that residual utopianism.
Okay, so you're saying Lacerdo was a humanist, and he wanted, and he was the one who, I don't know, I couldn't tell if you're talking about Althusser or Lacerdo.
Lacerdo.
Okay, because he becomes a major opponent of Althusser.
Yeah, right, big time.
But yeah, the messianic aspect of it was a really interesting part of this essay, or the you know, these series of essays, which are on New International Mag, by the way. The links are in the show
notes.
Yeah,
shout out.
It seems like the main messianic point of it is this question you mentioned previously about Marx said the state was going to wither away. He was, you know, he wasn't being ambiguous. He was ambiguous about some things, but not that. And so I guess central to Lacerdo's project is saying, no, the state's actually good. Look at all of these post-colonial countries forming nation states. That's the communist project today. And anyone who still says that the communist project is about class struggle and a dictatorship of the proletariat, which smashes and then withers away the state, are, I don't even know if you call them revisionists. He sort of just calls them wrong and
utopians, unrealistic,
and it's not him who calls them all CIA ops, but we'll get to that later, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And so, I mean, he's produced a series of books. I think there are 10 total in English translation. A bunch of articles of his and interviews with him have been translated into English. So he's very anti-Heideggerian, which is something that I'm not, you know, I'm not mad at. I'm not a fan of Heidegger. He's very anti-Nietzschean. He wrote a massive tome, 1,000-plus pages against Nietzsche. He wrote a book. It's not really a Stalin biography, but it's more about the sort of narratives that surrounded Stalin and the way that he was perceived in various quarters. That has a lot of problems. Very, very controversial book. And then this most recent book that I kind of used as a sort of a springboard for my own polemic is this book, an extended polemic against what he terms Western Marxists, really taking Perry Anderson's famous book, Considerations on Western Marxism, as a foil. Yeah, so he in this category, like how I begin the piece is kind of trying to question this category of Western Marxism, which is an umbrella term that houses under it, I think, a number of different widely divergent tendencies. I think it's kind of it's an incoherent category, largely combining a number of different, you know, tendencies and theories that really don't mesh at all and which are often at odds with each other. But he is interested. The unifying feature for him is that they all sort of rejected the sort of model of success that was achieved in the actually existing socialist countries, and they neglected to pay proper attention to the anti-colonial revolts that were breaking out around them.
And so, yeah, you go through the history of the term Western Marxism, and it kind of seems like there is something you could call a Western Marxism in terms of like the strains of Marxism that formed outside of the Soviet Union and then sort of came to be critical of the Soviet Union, like Rosa Luxemburg, for instance, and then Frankfurt School, stuff like that.
He even considers Trotsky a Western Marxist in a way.
Well, because he was strange. You know, rootless and left his country right. for some reason. Why did he leave his country?
I don't know. He was a rootless cosmopolitan.
Stalin stayed as a proud patriot. But then in Western Marxism, Lacerdo's book, he throws in Hannah Arendt, yeah. Michel Foucault, and even Giorgio Agamben, who I don't think is a Marxist at all.
He's a Heideggerian, right?
Yeah, none of them really are Marxists.
You go over how like Arendt and Foucault are like fellow travelers in a sense, but Agamben's way off.
Yeah, I mean, Foucault had like a brief flirtation with Maoism, but I don't think by any stretch of the imagination could be considered a... I mean, he dismissed Marx as a minor Ricardian, which I...
It's a cool reading.
One can get any number of insights from his books. I mean, he... did a lot of rich, interesting textual analysis or archaeology. But, I mean, it's just strange that Lacerdo spends all this time on him and Hannah Arendt, who's just like...
And I think you yeah. I think you pointed out in the section on that like, it's not strawmanning this conception of, like, a non-Stalinist Marxism to bring this kind of postmodern melange of people together and call that all Western Marxism. Like, he could have dealt with like the socialism or Barbary, Situationist International, Council Communists, could have dealt with Bordiga and the left communists, but instead he kind of chooses this almost straw man kind of grab bag. I think you argue for polemical purposes, right? To try to make a political point, essentially. Right.
Yeah, and I mean, the through line, I guess, he would try to claim is that, I guess, Hart and Negri took some of Arendt's ideas in their book on empire, which, again, is kind of a stretch. I mean, I still don't see how it justifies, like, fully, like, a fifth of the book proper to spend on that. These non-Marxists who, you know, by only, like, really expanding, like, the concept of Western Marxism to this ridiculous... amalgam that you could even like include them under that rubric. Yeah.
There's something kind of postmodern about Lacerdo, or that's the sense that I got through your piece. There's this sort of, I wouldn't say relativistic thing, but one of his main arguments, as I understand it, is that like the class struggle, as we know it and perceive it, is only one way, in fact, like a minor way in which class antagonism expresses itself and capitalism's contradictions express themselves. Geopolitics, of course, and like goings on within the actually existing socialist state, things of this sort for him are kind of on par with or greater than the economic class struggle. So I'm not saying that that's postmodern per se, but he kind of has like a relativistic sort of sense of things. And that's, I think, expressed in this grab bag of people that he wants to grab. He wants to critique the postmodernist, maybe by being a postmodernist himself. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, he has this other book that kind of presents his overarching theoretical framework called Class Struggle, where he tries to read class struggle in the plural. So... workers versus capital is just one of the three main forms of class struggle that he identifies. The other one occurs within the domestic sphere, which is like women's liberation struggles and so on. And the third one is national struggles against imperialism. So that's where it gets into geopolitics. And so I feel like he really doesn't. Well, obviously, you know, socialists have always historically fought for women's liberation. And in different times, they've supported different national independence movements as part of like the global revolt against imperialism, as part of fomenting world revolution. He really doesn't spell out the specificity of, you know, any of these struggles or the logic that binds them together, which I think for Marx, in a rigorous sense, you really have to ground the fundamental antagonism of society as labor and labor power versus capital. For him, the primary contradiction, and again, this is a very Mao-inflected term, is instead imperialism. And so there are sort of proletariat nations, or you know, the various workers' states that have existed, and our job is to support them against imperialism, against America, against NATO, and even beyond that, you know, especially since Marxist-led anti-colonial revolts have receded, now to just support various strongman dictatorships, the Assad regime, of course, in the past, Gaddafi, theocratic Iran, against against, you know, Western militarism.
It seems like a lot of the people he's targeting weren't totally ignorant or disapproving of national liberation struggles, specific ones, but they tended to be somewhat critical, or, you know, have different things to say about it than like the kind of typical new left anti-imperialist cheerleading. And so he would cherry pick these quotes. Can you think of any examples of that? You know, like, just,
I mean, the most baffling one, of course, is Sartre. Like, how you can construe him as not being an anti-colonial activist is really a stretch. I mean, he, you know, was probably the most vocal, you know, opponent of the French involvement in Algeria that one can imagine. The reason why he specifically objects to Sartre's framework is that he believes that anti-colonial revolt necessarily has two phases. The first phase is a military phase of kicking the colonial forces out, and the second is a sort of state building, economic industrialization phase. And given that he was so interested in what he calls the fused group, which is in his taxonomy of different groupings, that's, you know, the sort of most enthusiastic form of revolt and of revolution. He believed that would lead to burnout and didn't have the kind of slow patience that is required of long-term state-building projects to build a sort of counter-hegemony against imperialism. So, I mean, again, like, just because, like, he didn't follow his own sort of two-stage formula of anti-colonialism, he indicts Sartre on that basis, which, again, just seems him and this other guy, who's not really as well known, this Italian Trotskyist, Sebastiano Tempanaro, also very vocal anti-colonial advocate. So, I mean, again, like, it's just because it's not exactly according to the sort of model of actually existing socialism that he himself promotes, that he is finding fault with them.
How much would you say that his worldview is just sort of a standard kind of neo-Maoism or neo-Stalinism? Do you think it's particularly pernicious in any specific way? Because obviously the people who take him up tend to be this, like, this sort of, you know, obviously MAGA communist is like a weird red-brown fringe. Do you think that there's something to his work that lends itself to that? Or is he just like a smarter Grover Fur?
Well, the relationship with Grover Fur is interesting because he actually wrote the Italian introduction to his book, Khrushchev Lied, which, again, Fur is an absolute crank.
You can't call it just Khrushchev Lied. You have to go through the entire subtitle. It's like a half a paragraph, the subtitle. I'll find it while you continue going.
That's because Khrushchev Lied is a great title. It's
great, yeah. But then, of course, Grover Fur's a crank, so the subtitle's like, how the blah, 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 blah. I'll find it. Go ahead.
Keep going. And I mean, it's interesting, too. I mean, the title of the second article in my trilogy against Lacerdo is Lacerdo Lies.
Nice.
Or Lacerdo's Lies. So that was actually not a title that I chose, but I'm absolutely fine with it.
Fire.
Good
job, Henry.
The whole title of the book, folks, of the Grover Fur book is Khrushchev Lied. The evidence that every scare quote revelation of Stalin parentheses and Beria's scare quote crimes in Nikita Khrushchev's infamous scare quote secret speech to the 20th Party Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union on February 25th, 1956.
That's in the title?
Yes. Is capitalized provably false. That is the title and subtitle of
the
book.
That's a Trump tweet.
Yeah, it's a Trump tweet. Trump is like Grover Fur, like somehow even darker than Grover Fur. I don't know.
And I mean, I fully accept that Khrushchev's secret speech was opportunistic and self-serving. But I mean, regardless, the way I would break it down, and yes, to be clear, Lacerda did write the introduction to the Italian edition of that book. So he, I would refer to as a kind of neo-Stalinist, specifically a Stalino-Dengist. Fur is actually more of a classical Maoist, so he sees China as having gone down the wrong path after the overthrow of the Gang of Four and the market reforms instituted by Deng. For Lacerda, and he's very much interested in, like, as Dengists invariably are, the sort of the move to the NEP that was inaugurated by Lenin as a kind of temporary measure to sort of catch their breath after a devastating civil war.
The new economic policy to reindustrialize, restabilize the economy.
Yeah, which did involve, like, reintroducing certain forms of property and legalized market, sale upon the market, in ways that had been abandoned during the period of war communism that had immediately preceded it. So Deng and his followers have sort of stretched this out indefinitely. Within Marxism-Leninism, that's, and especially among the various Maoists of the West and around the world, not just the West, the Naxalites, for example, are Maoists who are very opposed to the line in Beijing. That's what Lacerda is going to bat for.
But this goes to show, I think, what one of your main theses in this whole text is, which is that Stalinism, you know, this used to be common knowledge, but I feel like it needs to be reiterated by you and by other people, is that Stalinism is like, it's a concession to defeat, and then it's making a virtue of various different necessities, right? The NEP wasn't a theoretical move by Lenin and the Politburo and company. It wasn't like deduced from first principles. It wasn't deduced from necessarily from Marxist logic. It was a temporary tactical retreat, right? Which you can then theorize about for sure, but to create dogma out of it, right, seems to be the move that Marxism-Leninism tries to do.
Yeah, and stretching it out kind of into the future, a sort of indefinite future. Well, I guess they do fix the date of 2050 is going to be the year that China achieves full communism.
Yeah. Push the communism button, baby. Push that button.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor that Lenin used when he advocated or introduced the idea of the NEP was that when you're scaling a mountain trying to reach the pinnacle of it, you perhaps have to climb down because you realize that the path towards it is untenable. But you're in fact just searching for another path. You're still looking to scale the mountain. So you have to maybe climb back down a bit in order to advance further. But regardless, I mean, Lenin, who was very orthodox on this question, still believed that it was absolutely necessary to coordinate an international proletarian revolution in the core, the beating heart of capitalism, which he believed the best that the USSR could do until that time was to sort of hold out until revolution in the West at the time came to its aid. Of course, that didn't really happen. The sort of like prospect of withering away the state, reabsorbing the functions that the state had taken on by society, reassuming those powers, was more or less put on the back burner indefinitely by Stalin. I mean, Stalin still paid lip service. What's interesting somewhat about Lacerda is that he actually goes one step further than Stalin in saying that,
right.
No, I mean, the idea of withering away the state or its eventual dissolution was always a mistake, and it's had catastrophic consequences for the Marxist movement historically.
So he's like sub-Stalinist on this question. Lacerda sees like the police state like smashing a boot on the human face forever, and that's a good thing. Like, yeah.
Yeah. You wrote something about how there's this critique of liberty I forgot who he was critiquing or what this argument was, but there was this idea of liberty and justice as things that like a communist project should guarantee. And the critique was, Well, justice is good, but I don't know about liberty. Liberty's.
Yeah, that was actually his critique of Badu, and that was one of the few times in the book where I'm like, oh, hey, actually, like, hit upon a decent point. He was saying, like, for like, as Badu had made this argument that, look, the Jacobins subordinated the idea of freedom to, you know, revolutionary justice, and in order to defend the revolution through, you know, virtue and terror. And Lacerda was like, are you saying that the Jacobins didn't care about freedom? But strangely, he just abandons that point and goes on this weird tangent involving Isaiah Berlin, which, again, if I was going to make like another broad point about this, he always is introducing these like bizarre hobby horses. And this appears in like all of these different books.
Isaiah Berlin comes up with a conception of positive and negative freedom, right?
Yeah, exactly. So freedom.
Very liberal.
Freedom from versus freedom for. So this is like one of the. And Badu has never once mentioned Isaiah Berlin in any of his writings. And the idea of like sort of tying him to Isaiah Berlin is incredibly far-fetched. The same thing, he's always dragging in Alexis de Tocqueville in every single book that he's written. In books about Nietzsche, like, I mean, again, Tocqueville is a figure that was maybe referenced once in the entire collected works of Nietzsche. It's just like generally, I mean, he has this sort of weird MO of like introducing like complete tangential arguments, unrelated figures, and then making these weird juxtapositions of, you know, here's what some Western Marxists said. Here's what Ho Chi Minh said. Mm. Here's what Adorno said. Here's what Mao said. And it's just like.
And it's all sort of under the premise of this orthodox Marxist. Like he's trying to say, like, this is more orthodox because it's like closer to like a real existing communist project. But at the same time, it's like sort of rejecting Marx and even Lenin, just kind of focusing on Stalinism and Maoism. So it's kind of interesting to think of a lot of these Stalinists as like not just people who defend Stalinism as like this moment of that the Soviet Union had to pass through, but actually liking Stalin more than Lenin and Marx.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the really polemical point that I really try to hammer home in the third part, which should be out by the time that this episode is released. I shared it with you guys, but the idea is that really, while he was defending a kind of Stalinist orthodoxy, or what he would, of course, would call Marxist-Leninist orthodoxy, Marxism-Leninism has very little of either Marx or Lenin in it, and departs in, I would claim, fundamental ways from the revolutionary doctrine of Marx, Engels, and Lenin. Particularly, the two points that I really dwell on are on this question of a coordinated international revolution, which they believed was a sine qua non of any true revolution, and then the question of the eventual dissolution of the state, its reabsorption by society.
And you point out in the third section, we're kind of jumping around, but I think it's all right here.
We're zigzagging. We're zigging. Traditional Stalinist fashion.
The suspended step, as Theory Communiste taught us. So you talk about in the third part that these conceptions, certainly the conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat and the wither away of the state, these aren't incidental, or these aren't political moves. They follow logically from the theoretical work, the philosophical work of Marx and Engels and Lenin. And it's not like you can extract them and like still keep the whole. It's enough of a revision, you argue, that like it might as well not be Marxism at that point, which Lacerda doesn't really seem to be too afraid of. He wants to bracket off like a utopian messianic Marx, Engels, and Lenin from like a realistic sort of state-centric kernel that he finds within that ideology, or certainly he finds within history, right? Uh-huh. He finds within history this realistic sort of kernel that you take some of the messianism of like Marx, I guess, as a rhetorical, you know, or like a polemical relief, but then you hard-headedly have to like smash up the kulaks, I guess, right?
Yeah, so what's interesting is like he and several of his works, including the work on Western Marxism, tries to reconceptualize the history of the communist movement as a kind of open-ended learning process, or a process of learning. So it's this kind of like trial and error, we'll figure out what works, throw as much as we can at the wall, and if it ends up departing from the principles of Marx, Engels, and Lenin, well, hey, maybe those things never really made sense to begin with, and whatever works is what we have to end up justifying. So he, you know, he ends up thinking because the revolution was contained to what more or less were the borders of the Russian Empire at the time, that, hey, this idea of revolution, especially revolution in the advanced corps, this is very typical of Stalinists, you know, especially the ones who go on and on about the labor aristocracy, as figures like Gabriel Rockhill do. They say, well, I mean, Marx and Engels did talk about this, even if they thought that revolution in the advanced capitalist corps was necessary. History has shown that, you know, revolution breaks out on the periphery, and it wasn't just the USSR, it was all the other states that followed. It was China, it was Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, etc., Angola. And hence, like, the prospect of organizing the proletariat in the West, the best that you can do is instead express solidarity, and I would claim largely just verbal solidarity, with these developmentalist regimes on the periphery of capitalism, and then pass that off as socialism. And then, of course, because instead of diminishing in size, the states of these various actually existing socialist regimes have just bloated to elephantine proportions, that the doctrine of the withering away of the state was, from the very outset, misguided. What I would say, of course, is that this kind of model of trial and error, a sort of empiricist model of history, of just like we see what works, is totally antithetical to the dialectical conception of Marx and Engels and Lenin following Marx and Engels. What they thought of, you know, the reason why they thought a revolution in the core of capitalism was necessary was deduced from their logical premises, their analysis of capitalism as a global phenomenon, from the reality of the world market, such that because capitalism was global in scope, so too would have to be the socialist revolution. And because logically the state was merely the instrument of class domination, when classes ceased to exist, so too would the state. Again, these are logical premises. These are not empirical questions. So I fundamentally disagree with Lacerdo's argument.
Yeah, reading Lacerdo, it's interesting. He seems very comfortable, again, critiquing and polemicizing against kind of 20th century liberals, essentially, which I guess is what his large book, his counter-liberalism book, is about. But we, and you know, I say ILC, and we've been doing reading groups and things like that in New York and across the country, recognize republicanism is not like coterminous with liberalism. It's like this current that kind of gets subsumed into it. But that, like, in 1917 was still like a live thing within the workers' movement, certainly within Russia. You know, it's the USSR, Soviet republics, right? I feel like Lacerdo, his blindness, and you point this out in the essay, towards like Lenin, Marx, and Engels' appreciation of American political freedom, say, as constrained as it is in the economic sphere, but as like baroque it is in the political sphere, that's not accidental either, right? That he wants to discuss liberalism, but he doesn't want to engage with the way in which Marx and Engels and Lenin were part of like a broader sort of Western tradition, where Marxism was deeply imbued in this sort of social republicanism.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, that's one of the other things, is that Lacerdo, and this is common to, I would say, most Stalinists, they constantly want to make the past dance to the tune of the present. So if the U.S. Is the sort of great Satan or the great imperialist rival of actually existing socialism, one has to go back and be anti-American throughout history. And in fact, he has an article about this where he expresses his consternation at various points where Marx and Engels really lauded the political freedoms enjoyed in the U.S. He claims that Marx and Engels were simply ignorant of, you know, the hypocrisies of liberal democracy such as it existed in the early U.S. Same with Lenin, who of course wrote this open letter to the American workers, who celebrated the American Revolution as this genuinely revolutionary attempt to overthrow feudalism. So all these things that, like, Marx, Engels, and Lenin had more or less taken for granted. Lacerda feels like he has to correct them somehow, as if he knows better than Marx, Engels, and Lenin. I would say largely colored by his own, sort of geopolitical opposition to, the American Empire, which, of course, admittedly, has done any number of horrible things in the 20th century and beyond.
But, of course, what happens with the creation of an American Empire towards the end of the 19th and definitely into the 20th century is like Marxism that Lacerda doesn't want to deal with. It's like the Bonapartism of, say, like Woodrow Wilson or FDR, this creation of this parasitic bureaucratic state that tries to subsume and manage capitalism on behalf of the nation state and the empire of the United States. This was a process, that happens. And it's a process that arises out of the contradictions of capital accumulation and the class struggle. For Lacerda's not interested in that. It's not to say that there's like some pristine American Republic, which like we want to get back to. But I think Lacerda's allergy to this like conception of political liberty, right, is in keeping with his sort of acceptance, making a virtue of a giant bureaucratic apparatus such as it existed in the USSR and to an extent exists in China today. So I don't know. I saw that. Is that a valid interpretation?
Yeah, I would say he's completely insensitive to the sort of historicizing gesture of Marxism, which really takes, which looks at the history of bourgeois revolution and the contradictions that arise with the Industrial Revolution. When America becomes a properly imperialist state, after the Civil War, I would say, when it finally actually completes its bourgeois revolution, with the ending of slavery, that's when the sort of monstrous appendages of imperialism begin to really attach itself to the American Republic, and it becomes imperial and, apotheosized in the figure of somebody like Woodrow Wilson and all those who followed him, FDR, an extremely Bonapartist figure, and beyond. He instead feels like he has to indict the American Revolution from its foundations as not living up to the radicalism of the French Revolution, which,
it's a very new left move, right?
Extremely.
Andy and I, last week's episode, Andy, I brought up the fact that all these like 90s Alex Jones, like Black Helicopter, like FEMA camp guys are completely quiet when it comes to like ICE officers covering their faces with masks and like jumping out of vehicles with assault rifles. And you rightfully said, like, Andy, that this points to hypocrisy, and it does. And I kind of left it there, but I've thought about that for the last week, and I've thought about like it's more than hypocrisy. Like, pointing out the hypocrisy of it is the new left move. It's like the Charles Beard move of like the early 20th century progressives of trying to like say that the Constitution was a counter-revolution, because if you look at all like the wealth that these founders, these slave owners had, you can't take seriously the ideas of freedom and liberty. But it's more than just hypocrisy. And, but it's also like these motherfuckers, like these are the tools that we need as a class to like break free from class domination. We need to like have Second Amendment rights. We need to have First Amendment rights. There needs to be some semblance of rule of law. Like, these are the building blocks that we need to use as a class in order to overthrow class domination. And it proves that these petty bourgeois motherfuckers are not serious about the contentions they have. They are hypocrites. They have a confused notion of government and the state or whatever. But more so, it's like we can't stop there. I feel like Lacerda and the new left, like, it's enough to point out the hypocrisy, to slag it off, to be completely cynical about power, to be cynical about the Republic, to be cynical about civil rights and liberties and freedoms and all that. And like, we all share that. We all have lived and grown up that way, right? But maybe growing up means putting the new left away, or at least moving beyond, sublating the new left and trying to find some new way to deal with these questions of power and politics and philosophy and liberty and civil rights. That doesn't just say like, well, we got to wait for the empire to collapse. That's all we can do. We got to look to Mama China to sort it out for us in the meantime.
Yeah, as a sort of surrogate for actual class struggle and the need to organize the class wherever one is. And that's really, I found the more I looked through it, like, the whole debate over Western Marxism, this is largely itself, I already pointed out how incoherent of a category I think it is, like combining these disparate strands. Really, this whole figure of Western Marxism was kind of a football kicked back and forth between different tendencies on the new left. And I would claim that Lacerda represents kind of a right tendency within the new left, a kind of vulgar anti-imperialist, anti-American tendency. And it's, I would say it's no mistake that he's been picked up by the Monthly Review, which, you know, had interesting origins, had interesting figures, especially early on, but I think is really in the last 10, 20 years, but even going back to the 70s, you know, always expressed this kind of sympathetic to actually existing socialism line that was more amenable to the kind of delinking and dependency theory style economic analysis.
To one thing that I want to bring up before we end this, it's not about Nietzsche, I hope that's okay.
Sure.
But you point out in your piece, and this is very interesting and enlightening, that anti-revisionism was itself revised. There was an original anti-revisionism, which was anti the Bernsteinite kind of reformist conception. And then you have, of course, the anti-revisionism after Khrushchev declares that the dictatorship of the proletariat is over and the state of all peoples has begun, right? It's interesting to me to look at Lacerda and neo-Stalinism as like one of many socialisms vying for prominence nowadays, when we live in essentially a sort of revisionist socialism, like a bourgeois socialism. You know, the contradictions and conflicts, as Rosa Luxemburg, you have a nice long quote in your piece about, it's about subsuming the class struggle and trying to paper over the conflicts and the contradictions within this giant bureaucratic state. Like, we have that. That's what we've had for over 100 years at this point in time. And we're not the primary victims of imperialism, but to the extent that that is an outwards and an inwards process, we are also ourselves too, not necessarily labor aristocrats, but victims of imperialism. And so what I would want to defend in the strain of Marxism that we, I think, broadly, right, agree with and take inspiration from, is that it's not only correct textually, it's not only in keeping with the great tradition of the workers' movement at its height in that 50-year period that you talked about, and large segments remain through the 20th century. It's also like, as we go through in the 21st century, and the 21st century has truly begun now, like we're in the second quarter of it, and it's like real now. We have moved far away from the 20th century. We're in a process of like disenlightenment right now. Literacy is dropping. Human sociality is like collapsing. Birth rates, you know, I'm not like a right winger natalist or whatever, but birth rates declining shows that like something's not happening that has happened for large swaths of the past. And so the kind of socialism, or even the kind of socialist movement that Lacerda and his acolytes, the neo-Stalinists, would argue for is one that's very well in keeping with a sort of disenlightenment of the working class. It says, again, it's a moralistic argument, but it's also rely on the leaders, rely on the professional theorists, rely on the PCI, rely on Deng, rely on Xi, Stalin, to tell you what is correct and what is wrong. Whereas I think what's needed right now, the kind of proletarian socialist movement that's needed right now, would also be fighting against this disenlightenment, this vulgarization of everything, this discoursization of everything, and be working to like give true like literature and art and sociality and power, develop that within the class itself, so that the class can truly become the heir to society as it's supposed to be, instead of this figure that Lacerda and Rockhill and others kind of trot out to be this, I don't know, this basis for the ideas that they create in their minds, these mind palaces that they create. It's given the imprimatur by the fact that, like, allegedly the working class is behind it when it isn't. So that's a long way of saying, like, even under the best scenario, I don't want any part of this movement that they're creating, this neo-Stalinist movement. I think that we need to do something completely different.
I would 100% co-sign that.
Fortunately, they're not really doing anything, so that's not going to be hard. Anything you do will be different.
And yeah, it's, I mean, I agree. Like, it's really the subsumption of the socialist movement into just state building projects, which then, you know, replace what the traditional vision of a post-capitalist society would be, which is the sort of reabsorption of state power and the functions that have been assumed by these massive structures that rule our lives by ourselves and us actually taking our destiny into our own hands, which will involve, of course, seizing state power at some point in order to shepherd society to the abolition of classes. I mean, there is the necessity, I think, of creating the kinds of institutions that can then thrive without this kind of body that hovers over them, superintending them. I think that, you know, for societies to sort of mature, to come to its own, to realize itself properly and not be subordinated to this other external power that is capital, its own alienated essence, it needs to, in some sense, take the reins of state power for a time, temporarily, until the state self-destructs through the, you know, the class's own self-abolition. I find that this is something that, I mean, of course, if I'm going to be polemical here for a second, it's something that sadly not only just the neo-Stalinists believe, but also they're the ones who they consider themselves in direct opposition to, the sort of milquetoast social democrats, mm-hmm. the people who, for them, like, socialism just means electing Bernie Sanders, means electing AOC, means electing Zoran Mamdani.
More on that in our event coming up September 13th at Ridgewood Commons, 6 p.m. Come see all of us. ILC is having an event about Mamdani and class independence, if it's possible to have one with the other. But I didn't mean to cut you off. I just saw a great point to
insert. No, in fact, that's kind of where I was hoping that you would go with it. Sean and I, Sean's going to be moderating the event. I've been kind of helping to coordinate it.
You are your director of the events committee, so of course you have, yeah.
Yeah, so it's good. It should be a really great discussion. It's titled Socialism in One City, with a question mark, kind of a provocation. But like, we're interested in looking back at the sort of long history of municipal socialism, such as it existed from Red Vienna, which is kind of many people think of as like the height of efforts to realize socialist policies at the city level, through our own native tradition here of sewer socialism in Milwaukee, through the sort of New Deal republicanism of LaGuardia, who is the figure that Mamdani patterns himself after the most. And to that end, I think we've got a really interesting lineup, if we can plug that for a minute, which is we've got an historian, David Hoysen, who I guess gave a series of lectures to the DSA on housing policy and municipal socialism, so absolutely perfect get. We've got a member of the DSA NPC, a member of the Marxist Unity Group, who's going to be speaking there. We've got a writer for Left Voice, a professor at CCNY, Olivia Wood. Really excited. She's written a couple articles on Mamdani. And finally, there is Harry Keats, who is going to be representing the internationalist perspective. It's just kind of a post-left com, very anti-electoralist. So there's a range of opinions. So the member of Marxist Unity Group, like, was a major figure in the Zoran campaign, very pro-Mamdani, I think probably with interesting nuances, figure who's more ambivalent about it, the writer for Left Voice, and someone who's very skeptical of even the prospect of electoralism in general. So I think it'll be a lot of interesting perspectives at that.
I think it will. And I think that, as usual, if you're in town, the real heat will be during the town hall when anybody can step up, unrecord, and grab a mic. And people can discuss what they just heard on the panel. But the panel will be on this podcast. You'll be checking it out. One last thing I'd like to say before we close out is that if you're a hard-headed realist about these things, you know, like Lasordo and others claim to be, there was a reality that existed in the Soviet Union, or the incipient Soviet Union, within the Russian Revolution, called the Soviets, called the councils, which were really real, and were really like an expression of a sort of civil, social bringing together of workers directly collapsing politics and economics in these factory councils. And this is where, like, I gain a lot of my inspiration from. And I know that the two of you do too. So it's like, when somebody just tells you, oh, we're just being realistic about history, there are a lot of different histories and counter histories that exist right there, and a lot of different realities that existed in the past. That, and we don't have to like glom onto Stalin as a figure representing all the best in the working class movement. We have a lot of examples of what our class can do when properly organized and inspired.
Yeah, the workers themselves, that really existed. And I mean,
it was real.
This council forum was a form of democracy, a form of workers' power, hearkening back to the Paris Commune, which, you know, Engels himself called the first dictatorship of the proletariat. And again, like, I mean, obviously history took its course. These projects failed, but they still, you know, remain, I think, you know, interesting sources of inspiration that, you know, if one is to really like meaningfully, break from the present, from the kind of depoliticized imagination that we have, the best is that we can just elect officials or, you know, root for America's enemies, you know, as opposed to just, you know, rooting for American imperialism, which is, you know, there's any number of American nationalists who do that. You know, there is this other form, which is people themselves, workers themselves, taking power in their own name in order to guide society to its conclusion.
Here, fucking here. Well, thank you, Ross. Anything else to add, Andy, or should we sign off? All right, folks. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Become a patron. Hear all our good bonus stuff. See you hopefully on September 13th. If we don't see you in person at the town hall to chop it up with us, you'll be listening to it here on this feed. So long, folks, and thanks for listening. X9 quase morto no porta-malas.